Good afternoon, everyone. Can I just get a bit of a thumbs up to check that people can hear me? There we go. So welcome to the second in our series on how to reform the police, which is today, how are police organisations actually reformed? This is an event hosted by LSE Ideas, which is the London School of Economics Foreign Policy think tank, and co-hosted with the Urban Violence Research Network and the Institute for Global City Policing at University College London. It's co-organised with myself and Dr. Zoha Wasim, who's a postdoc fellow at the IGCP. I'll introduce her and the rest of our panellists a little later on. Before I begin, I'll do a shout out to Dave Sutton and Jess Keaton, who have been helping us to put the event together. So thank you very much for your assistance. The overview or the format for the day is we'll have our speakers will speak for about 10 minutes each, and then we'll move in to Zoha as a discussant and a Q&A. It's an hour plus 30 format, which means some of our speakers will have to leave after an hour, but many of us will be able to stay online and we can take for the duration of the 90 minutes. Couple of other housekeeping things. This event is being recorded. Please do use our hashtag, which is LSE, hashtag LSE Police Reform. So it seems like almost every day there is something about policing in the news. Today I was greeted with a headline in the UK about the shooting in Chicago. And it shows just how prominent policing is in public discourse, not just in the United Kingdom, United States, but throughout the world. I also came across a quote which I thought was quite interesting because it demonstrates just how important policing is. I think it comes from Martin Luther King, and it was that public safety is not just about the absence of crime, but about the presence of justice. And sadly, neither the absence of crime nor the presence of justice, well, in many parts of the world, we have too much of the former and not enough of the latter. This series asks what determines successful reform and how can we best go about contributing towards it. It builds on an event we had last month at King's College London, which looked at police reform in the Global South. The following three events, including today, today we'll look more at the organisational level. Our third event on the 30th of April looks at police reform movements, and the final event looks at donors and how they can contribute to reform. What we're also trying to do is bring together themes and geographies which don't always come together in these such types of fora, from thematically criminology, political science, the donor community, and across geographies. I'm delighted to have our distinguished panel, who are both representatives of those various communities and can actually talk to all three of those subject areas. So I'm going to introduce them individually before they speak. And our first panelist is Shota Utiashvili, who amongst many of the things he's done in his career was first deputy minister in the Ministry of Penitentiary in Georgia. He's worked prominently in civil society and as a journalist in the country. He's currently a senior fellow at the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. I knew him when I did my PhD research. He kindly gave me an interview as director of the Department of Information and Analysis from 2004 to 2012, which was after the Rose Revolution in 2003, which means he was at the forefront of one of the most prominent examples of successful police reform we have in the Global South in recent times. So I'm going to turn over to Shota.
Thank you, Liam. It's an honor and pleasure to speak in front of such a distinguished audience. In 2003, Georgia was 124th in 133 countries surveyed by Transparency International in terms of corruption. In 2010, the same Transparency International said it was one of the least corrupt countries in Europe and the most uncorrupt, if I may say so, in the Eastern Europe. The World Bank says that in 2003, only 10% of the population trusted the police, and in 2011, it was over 80%. Number of reported crimes fell from 66,000 in 2006 to 22,000 in 2012. That happened 10 years ago. The reforms basically finished 10 years ago, and the government has changed in Georgia since then, but the reform has turned out to be quite sustainable. And although in some aspects controversial too, and we can touch upon that too. As Liam said, I was the head of analytical department in charge of coordinating these reforms from 2004 to 2012. And let me, from a practitioner's viewpoint, describe what we did. As I said, it was one of the worst police forces. Usually post-Soviet police is pretty bad, if not very bad, and Georgia was one of the worst among them. We started the reform, and we had to think about what to do first, where to start. And we decided that the most important thing about the reform would be to gain the public trust. Because you can imagine in those years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, how many governments have said that they were about to reform the police, and how many times it has failed before. So there was this lack of trust that anybody would really try to take on this institution. And there was the argument also that this is a cultural thing, you know, this is post-Soviet, this is Eastern Europe, you know, this is far into the East. So that's how things will always be. So the first thing that we have done almost immediately in summer of 2004 was decided to take on the traffic police. The traffic police is not obviously the most important part of the police, but it is the most visible one. So people usually form their opinion about the police when they see the traffic police in the streets. And the Georgian traffic police was notoriously bad, and it was notoriously oversized. It deployed 16,000 officers in a country of almost 4 million. That's a huge force. And we thought, what should we do about these guys? 16,000 is a big number. Can we reform them? The point was that these people had come to work for police, not to be honest, basically. They had applied for the job knowing that they would not get decent salaries and they would have just to basically extort the drivers. Most of them even had paid a bribe to obtain that position. And that's not unique to Georgia. That is a pretty widespread thing in the former Soviet Union, and I guess beyond that too. So we decided, you know, if we want to convince the public that we are serious about the reform, they should see a different traffic police, and then they might believe us. And we had to do this thing quite drastically. We had to fire 16,000 guys at once in summer of 2004. And strangely, looks paradoxical, but we had no traffic police for almost 2 weeks before the new guys got their training. And I have to say that this did not dramatically increase the number of traffic accidents. And we created a new patrol police that had initially about 2,500 employees that had only undergone almost no more than 2 weeks of training, and most of the later training were done on the job. And the people loved it because they saw a completely new face of the police. These new guys were not taking bribes. They looked different. They drove different cars. They had different uniform. And that was a good momentum to start the reform. The next thing, quite painful also to do, was to downsize. You know, the post-Soviet states have this tendency to have the unusually large police force, because the police force, it's not only about the law and order, you know, it's mostly they are the most loyal foundation of whatever the ruling regime is. If you look at Georgia in 2003, you know, with its police, security ministry, border guards, this kind of law enforcement force, that kind of law enforcement force, it numbered about 80,000. They were used against the crime, but also, you know, to help the government in the elections, to quell the public protests, to silence the people if that was needed, and so on and so on. And there was no way the government could pay these many people. And we had to basically bring the number down to about 28,000. Almost 50,000 people that had to be laid off. Again, very painful thing to do, but hardly any other choice. There is no way you can pay decent salaries to 82,000 law enforcement people. The next big thing that I think was crucial was this train, as much as you can, because you have this huge turnover. Not only the old people, old guard leaves, but also those youngsters who come to join the police force who are very enthused at the first time. And you discover that almost two-thirds of them leaves, because when they discover the police is not machismo, if I can say so. About the police, it's a very, very difficult and not very well paid job to do. So basically, our training centers had to work 24/7 for the new recruits, but also for those people who we're trying to promote. And we had to get rid of most of the senior police officers, and the best way to create a good organizational culture is that try to promote the people from the lower ranks, those who are younger and those who did not have much experience with the previous practices. And then, of course, one of the key things is no impunity for everybody, especially those that you bring to the work, those who are younger and who are supposed to be the new face of the police. So we had we have basically zero tolerance policy towards the corruption. If the patrol policeman, the traffic policeman, take a bribe, and he could go to jail for 6-7 years for taking as little as $10 from the driver. But this is how we try to maintain the discipline. And one very important lesson from Georgia is that there is no way you can reform the police and leave other parts of the government untouched. You cannot have a clean policeman and have the corrupt tax inspector or the customs officer. You have to take on the system pretty much all at once. So sounds difficult, but all the other alternatives are much more difficult. Then obviously one thing that was clear in Georgia for us, that you don't even need a bicycle. There are so many international examples that you can and you should use that you have to rely on your partners. Like our police training curriculum was totally set up with the help of our friend. We copied and pasted some EU laws and regulations. The laws also, you know, one of the biggest Georgia's problem was the organized crime that is largely gone, but still remains, especially the Georgian mafia bosses have now relocated mostly to Europe and are now harassing Georgian migrants in European and some other post-Soviet countries. So to fight the organized crime, we had to basically copy and paste the Italian anti-mafia laws. No need to invent the bicycle anyway. Also, the weak American RICO laws were again, you know, copied and pasted. So we were using all the help that we could get. Not that much financial, because at the end, every country must have a police force that it can afford. But in terms of experience and in terms of laws and regulations. One crucial thing is also that when you do the police reform, you have very, very little time. Because even if you initially have the public support, then you know the old elite reconsolidates, then your new police records start to do stupid things because some of them are not really happy, or some of them think that they're so good, everything is allowed for them to do. So, you know, within a month or a year, you have to show some initial results to build the momentum behind the reform. And finally, not to overuse my time, is that law enforcement reform, law and order reform, rule of law reform is so much more than just changing the police. The crown jewel is the reform of the prosecution, but most importantly, of course, the reform of the court system. And this is where basically we failed. The courts, Georgia didn't really have much tradition, or any other post-Soviet countries don't really have the tradition of having the independent courts, and most of the judges consider themselves government employees and are happy to do whatever the government tells them to do. And from the sort of servants of the previous government, then these judges became servants of our government, and when the government changed, they happily jumped and now serve and the next one. And again, there is this talk that Georgia needs to somehow do the court reform. But at least, you know, the police reform stays. And now, before the COVID started, Georgia has had three times as many foreign visitors as the population. So that it says a lot about the safety and security that both the Georgians and the visitors feel. Yeah, let me finish here and I'll be happy to answer the questions later. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Shoka. I think one of the things that really interests me about Georgia is in when we're talking about police reform, when we talk about police reform in post-Soviet space, but also elsewhere, we often talk about these things will take a generation. And whilst that's true at some level, I think what's really interesting about Georgia is it shows that where there is political will and capacity, it can be done actually quite quickly, at least elements of it can do. Let me turn next to our next panelist. So I'm just bringing up my notes. Is Heather Sutton. So first of all, a big thank you for Heather, who you may have noticed a change so we don't have Nathalie, but we have Heather, who has over a decade of experience working on violent prevention and development issues in Latin America and the Caribbean, in research, advocacy, and policy, and I think programming too as well, including working for the Inter-American Development Bank, the UN, and SUDAPAD as well. She is a public safety expert on the citizens security team at IADB, and she's currently working on a flagship publication, Police Management in the Principal Cities Latin America and the Caribbean, which includes extensive research on police agents, over 20 police agencies. So with no further ado, over to Heather.
Thank you. Thank you everyone for being here as well. And thanks for this incredible event. I think, in fact, as you mentioned, this is an issue that the Inter-American Development Bank is very involved in, and we're currently developing this flagship publication, for launch later this year, and I'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end. But let me just get started. I have a short presentation. Let me go ahead and do we have the PowerPoint? There we go. I will be using a PowerPoint. Sorry, I'll try and be brief and a little bit more dynamic. Just to give you a bit of background first, the Inter-American Development Bank, we work to improve lives in Latin America and the Caribbean. And today, the IDB is the leading source of development financing for the region. We provide financial and technical support for countries throughout the region that are working to reduce poverty and inequality. And with regards to policing specifically, over the last 20 years, the citizen security group within the IDB has supported various agencies in a range of capacity building and institutional strengthening initiatives. We've supported police forces in everything from some very deep focused reforms on human capital development in Honduras, for example, which I'll talk about in a minute, to the development of crime analysis units and new information systems for targeted patrolling in Uruguay, to sort of a combination of these approaches in countries like Ecuador. And we found that overall, a crucial part of knowing how to better support police forces for the IDB has been understanding how the police forces in our region are adapting and responding to modern challenges that they face. And unfortunately, as much of this audience will know, the overwhelming majority of research evidence on what works in policing comes from countries in the global north, where institutions, especially police institutions, are vastly different from the Latin American and Caribbean region, and they operate in a very different context. So I thought I'd give you just a quick couple of slides about the context in Latin America and the Caribbean. So next slide, please. And you can go to the next one there. There we go. So just to give you a bit of an idea, the countries in the region are very diverse, but they all have one thing in common, which is that they are all affected to varying degrees by violent crime. And these charts show, you may all be aware, but the average homicide rates in the world by region over the last 15 years, for which we have data from UNODC. And we can see that, you know, Latin America had homicide rates that were, that's that green bar, twice the global average, robbery rates about three times the global average. And you know, partially there are many, many factors involved here, but partially there's a geographic location issue where, you know, several countries in Central America and the Caribbean, which have some of the highest homicide rates, are in this corridor of drug and gun trafficking routes between the United States and the rest of the world, and thus have been exposed to very, you know, a lot of high levels of organized crime pressures, which are extremely challenging for police forces and for the criminal justice system. Next slide. And then looking at police in the region, if we look at the police to population ratios across regions around the world, we can see that, you know, the number of police officers in Latin America and the Caribbean is not a problem. Police force size is actually higher than the world average of about 350 per 100,000 inhabitants. Next slide. But we do see, you know, low police and prosecutorial capacity, which results in very low, you know, conviction rates. So you can see here, for example, in the green bar, we had, this is again for the last 15 years of data, but only about 15% of homicides resulted in a conviction over the last 15 years in the region, putting Latin America and the Caribbean amongst some of the lowest conviction rates in the world. Next slide. And it's also then not surprising that trust in the police is very low in the regions, with only about 36% of citizens saying that they trust the police on average. This is, you know, public opinion polls, compared to an international average of around 70%. Next slide. And then within this context, and I'll pause a minute here just to say that we see sort of very weak institutional capacity for the police forces. So policing institutions throughout the region are plagued by, you know, major deficiencies in human resources, in training processes, the absence of a clear career path for officers, insufficient resources and working conditions. And so a lot of the, you know, the evidence and the research that we read from the Global North is focused very specifically on, you know, deployment strategies or specific policing programs. And it's hard to see how these could have an impact in our region while we still continue to see such enormous structural and institutional challenges for police forces. So if we zoom in, and this is just some preliminary data from our study, as Liam mentioned, 20 police forces in the Latin American region, and also three police forces from outside the region, which were the New York Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department, and also the Madrid Police Force, the National Police of Spain, but in the city of Madrid. And we found that, for example, agencies in Latin America are significantly younger than outside the region. So over 60% of the police forces were under age of 35. We have fewer civilian officers to perform sort of non-operational tasks like data analysis and some of these other functions that don't necessarily require powers of arrest. We have lower levels of education for officers. So about 14% of police officers in the region on average hold a university degree, compared to almost half of the international agencies that we surveyed. So next slide, please. And then in addition to that, you know, there's also lower capital endowment and technology. So in these charts, you can see that, for example, there's in the LAC region, Latin America and the Caribbean, there's about one computer for every 37 police officers and one radio for every six, compared to outside the region where we have, you know, one computer for every two police officers and one radio for every officer on average. Next slide. And then just to touch on the issue of gender, there's really a similar division of female officers. About 20% of the police force in the agencies that we surveyed were female in Latin America versus 25% outside the region. But there's, on the right-hand side, you can see significantly lower number of female officers in high-level positions. So that dark blue bar is police chiefs and directors. And so you can see our region has significantly lower levels of females participating in the leadership positions within police forces. So next slide. And then the question really is, you know, superficial changes or institutional reforms. And what we've seen as international donors in the region is, you know, often there are offers to support police in Latin America and the Caribbean with either, you know, the new advanced equipment and technology, the shiny tools, and or some very specific training on policing models and techniques. But again, these reforms, you know, these forms of assistance often land in what we would say in Spanish, like infertile soil. So of policing institutions that are unable to use them effectively because they lack, you know, the fundamental institutional capacity to make it sustainable. So this, you know, it illustrates another central challenge, which is that there are various subsystems within every police organization that are so intertwined, and where I think many police reforms often fail is that they're not cross-cutting throughout the entire organization. And a good example of this is, for example, you know, better vetting and hiring processes will be insufficient unless there is, you know, equal emphasis on training, incentive systems within the institution, and institutional culture. If these are aligned to, for example, to reduce abuse and corruption, and if they're not all aligned, you're unlikely to have a successful reform. And that doesn't mean, I know policymakers really don't like to hear that you have to do everything all at once and it's going to take forever to reform a police organization, but it doesn't mean that we have to address everything at once, but I think it does mean that there should be some sort of coherent approach to addressing a particular focus across these various subsystems within the policing organization. And I'll just give a very quick example of some work from the IDB that we've been supporting in Honduras. You can move to the next slide. There we go. So over the last several years, the IDB has been supporting a vast reform of policing in Honduras. We had two loan operations that involved police reform. The first focused mostly on reforming the basic training and selection of entry-level officers and also improving criminal investigation capacity. And the National Police Force in Honduras, while there still are many, many challenges, they've gone really through an enormous transformation, including this completely revamped curriculum and basic training, plus improved pay. And there was also an investment in the physical infrastructure of the training academy in criminal investigation labs, and the creation and strengthening of an internal affairs unit. And then the second operation approved in 2018 has involved modernizing police stations specifically in two major cities in the country. And those police stations now are beginning to include a specific facility to deal with intrafamiliar violence. So, which include medical personnel and connection to prosecution services specifically for that type of violence. So next slide. While there are, as I mentioned, still many, many challenges, we have, after 8 years, seen a 50 percentage point reduction in homicide rates in the country, and an independent evaluation, impact evaluation, attributed about 11% of that decrease to police reform. There was a 50% increase in the level of citizen trust in the national police in the last 7 years. The academic and criminal investigation infrastructure now within the police force is a reference in the region, and it's made it possible to graduate 9,000 new entry-level officers trained on this new curriculum. It also resulted in far greater participation of women in the police force in Honduras. So from 2011, where we had about 10% of the police force were female, to 2021 now with about 25%. So next slide. And just to kind of some of the key, you know, summarize some of those six main components of the police reform there so far, has been stronger criteria for admission of new recruits. Really, before the reform, anyone with less than, you know, with even less than 6 years of schooling education could become a police officer now. A minimum requirement is a high school degree, and they're amongst many other criteria as well. Police are trained in this new curriculum that reinforces the philosophy that police forces serve a community, and the sort of essential respect for human rights. There is the incorporation of women, which has been really, really important, given that they are 50% of the population, and we need to reflect the communities that police work for in the police force. Improved working conditions. So as I mentioned, salaries increased actually 40%. There was also, you know, new sort of state-of-the-art equipment provided together with training on that equipment. So, and, you know, new information systems that allow operational control of all police units, and police cars now have computers that allow access in real time to officers to databases. And finally, civil society participation, which has been key and been also a challenge, I think. But there was a sort of a purification commission that was formed with the objective of separating out police personnel who receive, you know, a high level of complaints of abuse or misconduct. And so far, there's been about 4,000 non-compliant officers that were removed from duty. So next slide, and I'll wrap up here, just mentioning this forthcoming publication that I mentioned in the beginning that the IDB has been working on. So, you know, where do police organizations in our region start with their reforms? I think it clearly depends on the specific needs of each agency, but we're working on this forthcoming study, which we think will be a great contribution, identifying some of those fundamental areas of need that need to be addressed for police forces in Latin America and the Caribbean, which has been a very large challenge given the closed and isolated nature of policing institutions in the region. You know, much of this basic information that I showed in some of the slides is just not publicly available. Policing organizations are not always open to working with researchers or to publicizing, making transparent the data about the institution. So this flagship study that the IDB will be putting forth later this year is really about mapping this information for the 20 police agencies in our region and three outside the region. And the study will also look at particularly evidence inside our region and internationally in various areas of legitimacy, management, human resources, operational strategies, technology, and accountability and oversight mechanisms across the board. And we'll make recommendations based on, you know, how to approach reforms based on the institutional strengths and weaknesses that a particular police force may have. So thanks a lot, and I look forward to answering any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Heather. I think that was absolutely fascinating. One thing that struck me was, at least in its early versions, a lot of the literature on security sector reform was based more on models and concepts and ideas from the West. And we're now getting much more data on how police in the Global South actually function and are able to, and it's great to see research that consolidates that and comes up with recommendations. Really interesting. So our next panelist is Ben Bradford, who has conducted extensive research on trust in the police. And we've seen that to be a prominent issue in Georgia and in Latin America, as well as cooperation and compliance in justice settings and an organizational justice within police organizations, amongst many other topics of interest. He's professor of global city policing at UCL and director of the Institute for Global City Policing. He's also one of the authors of the SAGE Handbook of Global Policing, and has led a number of projects, including one on organizational justice in comparative perspective. So he's a good example of a Western criminologist who looks beyond the West. So delighted to have him here, and I'll turn over to Ben.
Thanks, Liam. Liam and Zoha for the invite to speak today. Not looking very far beyond the West today, unfortunately, but hopefully it has some kind of relevance. So I'm not an expert on police reform in the way that all the other members of this panel are. But when I was asked to come along and speak today, it occurred to me that the first question to answer is what we mean by reform. And there seems to be three different levels here. I'm sure there are many more, but these are just the three that I thought of. So we could be thinking about the general process of change and development in which most all police organisations are constantly engaged. So here we might talk about the reform of a particular practice or tool, or bringing something new in. So I think I put kind of hotspots policing in that category. We could be talking about a wider programme of systematic or strategic change, for example, related to general modes of policing adopted by particular organisations when they're done properly. So here we could be talking about community policing, evidence-based policing, problem-oriented policing, if you're doing these things properly, systematic change. Or we could be talking about what we've actually been talking about so far, which I think is wholesale change to the organisation itself. But even there, there's a continuum, there's a spectrum. So that runs from things like the formation of Police Scotland, through the Patton Report and the formation of police service in Northern Ireland, to the kinds of things that Shota and to an extent Heather were talking about, you know, just completely doing away with the old organisation and bringing in a new one. I think most of what I've got to say relates primarily to the first two notions of reform, although I think it actually has quite a lot of relevance to the latter as well. I might come back to that at the end if there's time. So what I'm interested in, and what I'm interested in more broadly really, is what motivates, in this case, police officers to engage with, take part in internalised reform processes. So to speak about that, I'll use an example from a recent paper I published with my colleagues, Laura Brimbaugh, Maria Hartwig, and John Jackson, where we looked at what might make police officers and actually law enforcement officers more widely, more or less open to the ideas and practices associated with, let's say, the evidence-based policing movement. I should note at the outset, this isn't a plug for evidence-based policing, although I'm generally in favour, because who wouldn't be? There are obviously some aspects of the debate around evidence-based policing that would mean we wouldn't want to be in a position of just claiming that because a police department does evidence-based policing, it is a reformed organisation. That's not what I'm trying to say. But what I am concerned with is what makes frontline police officers more or less open to what is undoubtedly a reform process in some ways. It's a pretty fundamental change to the way policing is done, if you're going to do it properly. I think it's also fairly clear that while the ideology of evidence-based policing and the evidence base that underpins it in itself have gained increasing traction in recent years, actual implementation remains patchy, and that's true in the UK, it's true in the US and globally. And it's really quite hard to say, or it has been so far, that there's been widespread take-up in any fundamental sense. And that's particularly the case in relation to frontline police officers, who are the ones who are actually meant to be doing evidence-based policing as they go about their business. So in the paper I'm talking to here, we looked at one particular area of policing where, according to the experts in this, by whom I mean Laura and Maria, research and practice are often seen as being in opposition in some pretty fundamental sense to one another, and that's interviewing practices. So these are scientific consensus is that current interrogation practices, both in criminal justice and kind of human intelligence gathering context, would benefit from a major evidence-based overhaul. So the experts in this field, and again, I'm no expert, seem to agree there's a pressing need to move existing practice in the direction of evidence-based techniques. But the critical question is, how are you going to do this? How can you get that change to occur? And as is so often the case, despite the amount of research on how you should do evidence-based interrogation, there's been little systematic effort to understand how you implement that how you implement evidence-based interrogation techniques, how you get police officers to do the things that you think they should be doing. I mean, of course, the barriers to reform in this area are well known. I'm not saying anything particularly revelatory here. There's often widespread resistance to new developments, new programs, new ways of working in policing, and particularly when reforms diverge significantly away from accepted operational practice, operational norms, and or stem from outside the police, which is often the case, as does David Bailey, among others, has noted over the years. So senior managers worry about losing control and the possibility of adverse publicity. Middle managers and supervisors see a challenge to their authority. People come from the outside and tell them what to do. And street level officers are frequently cynical about just another new programme and resentful of outside interference in their work. And at the front line, which is what I'm particularly interested in here, three things are particularly important. We know all this. This has been a mainstay of police studies for decades. There's the long list of problems associated with police culture. So cynicism, pessimism, conservatism, action orientation, some of which we've already heard about, the inward looking mentality, all of which would likely to inhibit processes of change. There's a frequently top-down nature of reform processes, which is usually, and in the case of evidence-based policing in particular, initiated at the behest of senior management, but which must be implemented by the front line. And police officers can often be cynical and suspicious, not just about outsiders, but also and particularly about their superiors, making them unwilling to implement change programmes they perceive as being handed down from on high within the organisation. And finally, of course, and again, this is nothing new, there's the fact that street level police officers are operating in low visibility environments without managerial oversight often. And in particular, in cases like the UK and the US, where this study was based, they're specifically empowered and encouraged to use their discretion when deciding on what to do to whom and why. So there's lots of barriers in the way of implementing change associated with, for example, evidence-based policing. And our basis question in the paper, basic premise, was to explore whether organisational justice can overcome some or all of these barriers and promote openness to change and engagement with evidence-led reform. So there's a growing body of work which suggests the best way to promote change within police organisations is changing the ways that officers relate to their organisation. And specifically, this body of work is drawing on a much wider body of organisational psychology, really, says that by adhering to principles of organisational justice within law enforcement agencies, senior managers and supervisors can encourage their frontline staff to adhere to rules and regulations, take on new ways of working and extra role activity, and modulate, change their attitudes and their behaviours towards those they please, making them more open to change, making them more amenable to doing things that you might want them to do under a reform process. And what the literature on organisational and actually procedural justice quite closely associated does is place the relationship between employee and organisation at the centre of understanding of way that people behave in organisational settings. And the key idea here is that people are sensitive to the way that their superiors wield power and authority. We attend very closely to whether the people supervising and managing us make decisions in an equitable, fair manner, are open and transparent with us, behave in an unbiased fashion, treat us with dignity and respect, communicate with us clearly, honestly, allow us a voice, and so forth. And when we feel that we're treated that way by people within our organisation, we assume that we come to the judgment they're trustworthy, we feel supported by the organisation, that we have a stake within it, and that the structures and processes of the organisation and the organisation itself is legitimate. An organisation, this sense of organisational justice, encourages to identify more with the organisation, identify more of its goals, and actually internalise those goals and make them our own goals in some pretty fundamental sense sometimes. And the assumption is that all of this, as I've suggested, promotes compliance, cooperation, extra role activities, organisational citizenship behaviours, whatever you want to call it. So in this paper, we used a sample of people who'd recently been trained in evidence-based interrogation techniques. And what I mean by that is, for example, these techniques have an emphasis on building rapport with suspects and witnesses and not trying to coerce information out of people. So not only are they evidence-based, they're actually ethically more desirable than current practice as well. And we found that the more investigators thought their organisation to be fair along the dimensions that I've described, the more they identified with it. the more legitimacy they granted it, the more legitimate they thought activities were. And in turn, this legitimacy and identification was associated with variables representing, we claim, openness to change, for example, willingness to take on new roles and responsibilities. And we also found, and this is the really important bit, that net of participants' overall personal motivation to attend the training, in other words, their personal motivation to engage with this evidence-based practice and perhaps apply in their work, those who worked for organisations they perceived to be organisationally more fair, and they came from a whole range of police organisations and other security actors right across the United States, those who worked for organisations they perceived to be more organisationally just, rated their likelihood of using next techniques when they went back to their job much higher than those who came from organizations they rated to be organizationally unjust, unfair. So there's this kind of direct link between working for an organization that you feel supports you, has your back, treats you in the right way, and your willingness to take up this evidence-based interrogation technique. And our findings really from this study resonate with many others in this kind of quite large and growing field of police organizational justice research. And the absolutely central point for me is if we want to change police organizations, we have to positively engage with the people who deliver policing. And that's always, almost invariably, frontline officers. And by we, I mean both external stakeholders, like academics running studies like the one I've just described, but also, and undoubtedly more importantly, those within the organization seeking change and with the power to affect it. If they don't get their relationship with the frontline right, I don't think it's a stretch to claim that reform efforts are doomed to fail. And when, you know, again, people like Wes Scogan and others have been saying this for years. And actually, if the change is structural, so if the change you're implementing is a kind of outside of the everyday experience of police officers, for example, the formation of Police Scotland or the formation of Police Service in Northern Ireland, if you don't get the organisational justice right, if you don't treat the officers going through that change process right, you can have many, many more barriers to that change person when otherwise would have been the case. It will run less smoothly, it's going to encounter more problems, and so on. So I think when you're thinking about reform processes, at least in the way I said at the beginning, when we're talking about those first and second categories, you have to concentrate in the first instance and always on what's going to encourage the officers going through that process to do the kinds of things that you want them to do. And I'll finish there, and I look forward to the Q&A later on. Thanks, Liam.
Great, thank you, Ben. Again, another, I look forward to reading the paper, and I think it's a good example of the findings from that paper, from my knowledge of police reform in the Global South, that there will be lots of crossover. And that's not always the case. And I've worked with civil society organizations who sometimes have quite a combative approach. And, you know, it's a place for that, but we also need some of the other elements too. But talking about someone who knows about civil society and the police, I'm delighted to have our final panelist, Rachel Neal, who is a division director at the Open Society Justice Initiative. Like I said, a wealth of initiative expertise relating to a variety of policing issues. I noted in one of your 1998 publications on civil society and the police earlier today, but has also done research on ethnic profiling and is a good example of someone who's worked across contexts, studying police in Europe, North America and Latin America. She's going to talk today about the importance of collaboration between police organisations and civil society. So it's a nice segue. So over to you, Rachel.
Thank you very much indeed. So I think my presentation may date me a little bit, and I do want to caveat some of what I say with the fact that particularly in Latin America, the civil society landscape has really evolved a huge amount, but I thought it was illustrative of some of the challenges that arise to reflect on work done some time ago. Anyway, I want to start by thinking quickly about three factors that really come into play a lot when you think about civil society engaging with police. And these are the motives, issues of expertise, and issues of access. In terms of motives, I come at this presentation really from my foot in human rights-based concern with police reform. I've moved to and fro a bit in my career and done more technical, including consulting for the IDB work, but I really fundamentally, I think of myself as a human rights activist concerned with policing, and that's the perspective I want to bring here. And so, of course, the basic concern with that approach is to end abuses, is to end police violence and killings and other abuse of power. For many groups, that perspective has broadened out at different times to encompass issues of service delivery and public safety, especially in areas, and this very much includes Latin America, but also South Africa, I think, were some of the most graphic examples, where crime and insecurity has just boomed, particularly in post-transitional periods. And one of the issues then is very much about people who are over-policed but under-protected. Some organizations have in fact deliberately chosen to focus purely then on the service delivery aspects of that and moved away from the human rights perspectives, and that's led to a growth of more technical organizations. One of the most intelligent people I think of doing that was Innocent Chukwuma in Nigeria, who came out of a human rights organization and established the Clean Foundation, who tragically, at a huge loss to the field, died last week. But historically, most human rights groups focused on abuse, of course, start with name and shame strategies. I mean, that's the bread and butter of the human rights movement. It is obviously inherently adversarial, and then it creates real problems if you try to engage with organizational reforms. And I think also something we often don't necessarily put at the fore, but is the emotional challenges of this work. You really cannot understate how difficult it is for civil society activists to engage directly with their oppressors. It's true of NGOs in many regions, but especially of community-based activists, those who live daily experiences of abuse and discrimination at the same time that they're trying to work on it and think about what it does, how you go about changing an organization to end that. One of the ways that one sees these issues then, let me turn to expertise. So civil society activists typically, obviously, have a great deal of expertise, direct personal experience in many cases with the impacts of bad policing. But they often have very little, sometimes no, grasp of police management and practice. So one of the issues is how to figure out what expertise to build and how to build that expertise. Here's where I think academic collaborations are incredibly important, but there's also a great deal of learning by doing in the field. And here, resources really matter. I would actually hazard a guess that it's easier to raise money for police reform work as a nonprofit organization in Latin America than it is to get resources to address profiling in Europe. In Europe, police bias issues remain incredibly controversial. Private philanthropy is scarce, it's often politically conservative, and government funding, which most NGOs rely on, isn't really available for work on profiling. Indeed, some of the associations that we've worked with have lost government grants when they took this issue up. So one shouldn't sort of make assumptions about the necessary advantages of addressing police reform in the West versus the South. The landscapes are quite particular. I would just notice on expertise that I think one of the things human rights organizations are realizing is that many of the recommendations that they have typically made in their reports call for things that we know from the evidence actually don't make any difference or not a significant difference. Two classic examples calling for human rights training and for independent complaints bodies. The complaints bodies certainly are a good and necessary thing, but they need to be part of a system of multiple levers of accountability that one pulls. And let me close my introduction here by saying something quickly about access. Not surprisingly, given reliance on name and shame, human rights groups' relationship with the police tends to be one of mutual hostility. Finding entry points then obviously can be incredibly challenging. In addition, groups face the challenge that academics and others often face, which is the deeply corporatist nature of policing institutions. And this is where I actually also think there are some legal and cultural differences that we need to pay a little more attention to between common law and civil law systems. Many police do not understand themselves as a public service. They are in culturally and legally an arm of the state with very little or no obligation to respond to public opinion until it becomes political opinion. And indeed, I have sat with French police who first called me a roast beef and then told me that no UK policing had any relevance to their practice. That's, you know, fun, but a serious issue when it comes to trying to engage in reforms, even in countries like France, especially at the moment. Common entry points then for engagement are often sort of soft targets like training academies. But I think that human rights training in particular and training more broadly does not change practice unless it is linked, as Heather pointed out, to other levers that you pull, other incentive systems. And then, yes, training is absolutely essential to make sure police know what they're doing in relation to those other reforms. But assuming that training changes practice is just demonstrably wrong. And most training, and I think this is true, frankly, in my experience for international donors as well as NGOs, is about building relationships and people you can call up later when you need to do something else. Another classic entry point that I have used a great deal is to find police allies from other places. Typically, when I've gone in, particularly in the start of work with police forces, I will always bring a police ally with me. It opens doors, it changes the nature of the conversation that you have. All of this said, when you get access, it's incredibly fragile. Windows of opportunity to engage with police reform open and close. They're often based on political transitions when they open or scandals creating pressure for reform. Civil society groups have to adapt constantly and they have to assess their risk tolerance for engaging with police. You can, it's quite dangerous in some circumstances to do this. It can also be a huge waste of time and scarce resources for an NGO to try to go in and engage with institutional reforms. On the other side of the coin too, though, I do think it's important to reflect on the fact that engaging with civil society has got risks for police officers as well. And we've seen this with officers we've worked with. Careers can advance, but they can also collapse. Reputation and even physical security can be threatened. So that said, I want to tell two short stories. The first is about Central America, and this really dates me quite a lot. The second is about profiling in Europe. In Central America, I worked with an organization called Washington Office on Latin America. My own work on policing actually started monitoring international assistance for police reform in Haiti. Which was quite an education. But we also, colleagues were monitoring policing reform and US assistance in particular in Central America. El Salvador was the main focus, but we were also looking at other countries, Guatemala especially, and had Honduras, which has always been rather neglected in the side mirror, as it were. What we saw in the late mid-90s, I guess, into late 90s and early aughts, was the drawdown of international assistance that had supported the reforms that came after water peace transitions. And we saw that drawdown starting to happen with some really quite impressive results, especially in El Salvador, in terms of changes in policing. But with almost no domestic constituency and civilian capacity to maintain and drive those reforms locally. They were incredibly internationally dependent. This was a history of militarization, but also I think a history of civil law systems in which there had been no academic criminology, and most of the people thinking about policing and crime were lawyers. We got money from a number of different donors to work in three countries to try to build expertise and constituency. We work with local partners. In each country, the partners selected the issues that they thought were interesting, neglected, or priorities. We recruited an eminent advisory board to support their research and try to help them if they had access issues. Our only requirement was that their research be policy-oriented and try to produce actionable recommendations. Amongst other things, they looked at community policing, congressional budget authority, and administrative discipline. And there was great work in a number of countries. Heather, we worked with Leticia Salomon, for example, in Honduras. But I would like to mention two things in Guatemala, which I found particularly interesting because of the sort of granular insights that they provided. Firstly, they took a very close look at budget authority and discovered that the police were allowed, once the budget was approved by Congress, the police could amend any line in that and reallocate budget without re-notifying Congress, something that members of Congress didn't seem to pay attention to or care about, which meant that any kind of political oversight by the legislature was an absolute myth. The other thing that they looked at was they analyzed the disciplinary code and then conducted about 200 interviews with officers, finding a system in which the code said almost nothing about contact with members of the public, but was deeply punitive and incredibly petty and could strip officers of salary for things like not ironing their uniforms properly. It created an extraordinarily abusive internal environment. I mean, it facilitated and drove an inherently militarized and abusive structure. Both findings did inform reforms at the time, but also I think a much deeper appreciation of the need for improvement in internal working conditions, and budget is a big issue there, where that budget goes, as well as your disciplinary system, to some of Ben's points. But I would say that one of the most important outcomes of that work was in building individual experts, almost all of whom have carried on working in the field, who have developed NGO work, who have served in government, including in ministerial positions, and who remain some of the most passionate and prominent advocates to this day for reform in the region. I think I'm running over time, but I did want to sort of briefly note work also that we did in Europe. And I'd like to talk about a project we did called Strategies for Effective Police Stop and Search, when we first started working on issues of ethnic profiling across the European Union. We had done some initial research based on interviews that had built relationships with police, and the collaboration to then actually test specific practices that could address profiling was very much facilitated by an EU grant that we got. So we did bring money to the table again. The original intent of STEPS was simply to demonstrate the feasibility of gathering ethnic disaggregated data through stop forms, because most police forces in Europe view ethnic data as illegal. In Spain, we actually got lucky, though. However, we went much beyond that initial sort of demonstration effort. And this was largely because we just got incredibly lucky in Spain. We were working with a very progressive and quite political chief of a municipal police force outside Madrid. And he happened to have an incredibly talented sergeant who conducted his own data analysis and then worked with the chief to apply that directly to operational practice. They managed to reduce disproportionality rates, they increased their hit rate, and they built out new community consultation mechanisms that first discussed data, but quite quickly moved into talking to other safety concerns, and really specific safety concerns, including things they had no idea about in the local Chinese community, for example. Now, Hungary and Bulgaria, the other countries we did this work in, were a rather more mixed picture for very different reasons. But in both, all three, I think, countries, police were surprised by some of the results. In Hungary, they had no idea that the sheer number of stops they conducted was far out of whack with any comparator that we could find from other European countries. And they had, not surprisingly, an extraordinarily low effectiveness rate as a result. In Bulgaria, we worked with the chief of the patrol police, the main body of the police, who assured us that they were very military and he had absolute command authority, and what he told the local regions and the pilots would go. This proved absolutely not to be the case. When we conducted an evaluation, he was indeed quite startled and interested by how in the chain of command and where in the chain of command things went wrong. I think the value of data and evidence-based management became extremely clear in different ways to all three of our country partners, but none of them fully withstood changes in political and police leadership. And again, here, to me, the ongoing work of partners has been just as interesting as the original project. The Spanish sergeant to this day is one of our partners and is currently co-authoring a manual on rights-based policing for the Council of Europe. A key Bulgarian partner became Minister of the Interior and continues to lead police reforms. And from a community perspective, rather to our surprise, one of our Roma community leaders actually joined the police. Furthermore, this has enabled a conversation with a wider group of police from other countries whom we brought together, and colleagues at Open Society are now trying to support a progressive policing network around issues of profiling, race bias, and disproportionality in policing. So I know I'm over, I will stop. So I will just say, I think civil society groups play this constant game of trying to balance an outside adversarial name and shame approach versus when they can bring value to those inside track engagements, where sometimes the risk is that you come across very serious violations, but you will destroy your relationship if you reveal them. For rights-based groups, this is basically an unacceptable compromise in many situations, but it is one that rights-based reformers have undertaken and developed a new set of organizations in civil society who specialize in reform. And finally, I would just say that what I really feel in my own career is that we must never look at these processes as linear. There is often in specific situations an analysis of a problem, sets of recommendations that come up, and we try to push towards them. And it creates a rather linear manner of thinking about processes and outcomes that we are seeking. Police reforms are inherently episodic and fragile. All police, even in the best and most developed Western democracies, have problems, and they come and go. You need the right kind of field and the balance of civil society activists along with others who can create the political pressures for reform and who can also work with others who have more independent, more comparative and more technical insights to engage and complement donor assistance, which may be driven by national security and other interests. The field needs to be diverse, it needs to be multi-sectoral, and I think it does have to include the NGOs and the name and shame, be it through advocacy and engagement. And in the words of Congressman John Lewis, we've got to keep making good trouble.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Having worked with civil society in the former Soviet Union, I can definitely advocate for them being the real change makers of that region, as indeed we found out today. I'm going to turn now to Zoha to wrap up. So as I said earlier, Zoha is a postdoc fellow at the Institute of Global City Policing. She's most recently been conducting ethnographic research on the impact of securitization policy in Pakistan and has two recent papers in policing and society. So check them out. But she has a range of other research interests, including comparative policing, urban security, institutional culture and reform, and thus is very well paced to try and wrap up for really interesting conversations. So over to you, Zoha.
Thank you, Liam. Definitely very interesting conversations and some very complex and ideas discussed as well. So thank you to everyone who was able to join us today and for the four speakers for presenting their insights and evidence. I'll speak for a few minutes. I did have a couple of questions towards the end, but I think I'm going to hold on to them. And then if there's time, I might pose them towards the end. So what I'll do for the next sort of a few minutes quickly is just touch upon some of the key themes that were covered or touched upon by our speakers. And they will resonate with some of the attendees and other people interested in police reform in other countries and contexts as well. So first, was very clear from all our speakers that public trust in the police remains critically important, and it's a constantly moving target. It's not linear, and it's something that has to be constantly negotiated. In Georgia, we saw reforms to increase public trust were quite drastic. Lots of downsizing, lots of layoffs. Although something so drastic may not work elsewhere, or sometimes might take quite long to evaluate. Second, we also heard from Ben that equally important is police officers' trust in their own organization. So it's important to think about what officers themselves perceive of top-down approaches or top-down change processes, and also imported change programs, those that are brought in by international donors, for example, and how fair officers deem their own organization to be, which can have a direct impact on how officers react to or welcome and then implement organizational change and change processes. And third, I particularly like the emphasis that Rachel placed on the emotional challenges of delivering reform, especially for civil society activists, and overall the importance that was placed on civil society's collaboration with the police and also academic collaboration with the police, which was a recurring theme, I think, in our presentations, and I'll come back to this in a second. So in terms of the recommendations or suggestions that were provided in our four presentations on how to reform the police, which was, you know, the key question guiding this event, we heard quite a few, but I'll touch upon a couple. So first, as Rachel sort of concluded with, we need a multi-sectoral strategy that encompasses a range of actors, including the judiciary, the military in authoritarian context, for example, civil society organizations, academics, and donors. This is actually also highlighted in one of Rachel's papers on democratic police reforms in war-torn societies, which I thought was really interesting. And it was also highlighted by Shota in the beginning, in the first presentation, that we can't reform the police without reforming other institutions of the government, such as the courts and prosecution services. Heather similarly talked about civil society participation. And on this point, Ben also prioritized looking at what police officers themselves think about the change being introduced. So police officers and personnel, alongside other sectors and institutions or allies, as Rachel had said, need to be collectively involved in the change process. A second recommendation or a suggestion, taking cue from what Heather had said, is that there will be differences in what works in the global north versus what works in the global south. So context-specific programs are particularly important because policing in southern contexts, for example, or in the developing world, will have certain structural and organizational challenges or institutional challenges. So we need to be a bit careful about transporting ideas as they are and transporting knowledge without regard for local dynamics. And without realizing, as Heather said, some areas might be hosting infertile soil. So reform projects might not take root or they might not be sustainable. This is, on this note, it's also important then to get buy-in from officers, especially field officers, as Ben said. And it's also important, based on both Ben and Rachel's presentations, is to see what evidence works in different contexts. So what will work in the UK and it might not be particularly useful in other countries, given the cultural and legal differences that Rachel discussed. And third, we heard some key organizational changes that might be effective in bringing about or delivering police reform, such as introducing training and curriculum design that prioritizes community services and human rights, improving pay, and improving the infrastructure of the police, but also what Ben said, to think about, again, how officers relate to their own organization and how they think about reform. So in this area, organizational justice or procedural justice within an organization becomes important as well. So just very quickly, for 1 minute, I'm just going to raise a couple of questions, very broad questions I have. And if anyone has time, we can go upon them. The first was, Heather briefly talked about the importance of gender. And we often do hear about the importance of inducting more women into the police and improving gender representation. So my question is, can greater participation of women in the police improve the culture of policing? And in what particular areas of policing do we need greater participation of women? So based on the cases you have studied, is there a direct correlation between the two? And related to the question of representation is a question I had on diversity within the police. So in your experiences, based on what you have seen in your specific context and work on police reform, is there a correlation between increasing diversity in policing or increasing minority representation in the police? and stronger police-community relations. So in other words, can greater minority representation in the police translate into positive police-community relations or not? And then my last question is about political will, which Liam had mentioned periodically, is that how do you ensure political will surrounding reform projects or a reform program? How do you ensure that it does not waver or fizzle out? So how do you get buy-in from political leadership, especially in the developing in the developing world where it might not be very sort of it's something that they are willing to commit to? So I'll stop here, and then we can open the floor for Q&A, or you can address my questions if you like. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Zaha. We've got a lot of questions, and Zaha's asked some very good and more questions as well. and we haven't got that much time. So what I think I'm going to do is separate the Q&A into two. We'll have Shota and Zaha first, and then I'm going to turn to Rachel and Ben. So I'm going to pick a couple of questions which I think you two, both sets, would be well placed to answer. Obviously, if you want to address some of the other questions, that just let's try and leave a little bit of time for the other group to respond. But the first question I want to ask is about what do you do with fired police? And then Andras has put a question about is there any guidance on salaries and the necessary level to be able to reduce corruption? So if we go to Shota and then to Zaha, and then we'll come on to another couple of questions for Ben and Rachel.
Well, thank you. About the salaries and corruption, you know, I wish there was some magic number or some formula, but there isn't. What we tried to do, though, was to try to raise salaries, even with minimal numbers, every year. So the policemen knew that if they stayed in the force long enough at some point, they would have more decent salaries. But, you know, the high-paid employees getting corruption as much as low-paid employees, and really, I don't think there is a correlation here. What do you do with the police that is fired? And that's a big question. Politically, at that time, the police was so unpopular that they decided to politically not challenge government at that time, but wait for the times when the government would commit mistakes and attack it later. What was good about the timing was that, you know, it was because of the reform was were so sweeping, the economy started to grow dramatically. You know, the economic growth reached 12% in 2007, and when you have such a high growth figures, then it's not that difficult to find a job, especially for the former policemen, who are usually people who are well connected and have certain skills that can be used. And then we had Georgian police, we have this thing that this is a big private security company that works under the police. They don't have, they're part of the Ministry of Interior, but they don't have any police in functions. Anybody just can hire them to protect their property. So a lot of the people who would get, were getting, who sort of left the actual police work, were taken to this private security or the government owned private security company. And then when I was saying that the time is short and you need to use the time while the reform is popular, that was exactly what I was referring to. At some point, of course, those who are negative to the reform can take a flag and then follow it. And one last thing about the representative minorities in the police. In Georgian experience, we had mostly ethnic minorities, and we had the language issues. So we had to basically invest quite a big sum of money to make sure that, first of all, we tried to hire the locals at every district. But then the problem was they didn't speak the language. And then we had to sort of give them years of training to become proficient in the language. Hiring from the local community is absolutely essential. There's no other way you can get the trust of the locals. If you just bring the police from somewhere else, they have to be local. Clear.
Okay, Zaha.
Yes, thank you for the questions. They were definitely very interesting. I don't have anything particularly different to add onto what Shota said in terms of what happens with fired police officers. I think based on the limited kind of understanding that I do have about fired police officers, I do think that depending on where they are, if they've got certain political connections, or if they've got, you know, a good network, so they will have certain private security companies, for example, or other similar jobs that they can fall back on as security guards or as people working for private security companies. So then in terms of salaries, the correlation between salaries and corruption, again, I mean, a separate panel can be done on police corruption because, it can be both financial but also moral. And also corruption, it's a debatable topic because some of it can be done just to kind of get by and meet basic ends, and some can be a lot more high level kind of corruption. So it depends on what we're talking about. Salaries might not necessarily be the only thing that can deter officers from corruption. So while it will definitely improve things, I think also in investments in police stations, for example, I think that's something I saw in the case of Pakistan, is that a lack of order or a shortage of direct investments coming into police stations and transparency about the money coming into police stations can often lead to certain lower level corruption. But in societies that are particularly divided on class lines, for example, which is a large part of our population, so class divisions can encourage greater and higher level forms of corruption, which is particularly more difficult to deal with. And I don't think salaries alone can address that kind of corruption. Thank you.
Okay, great. There's a couple of other questions which I'm going to put to Ben and Rachel, though I think they may be responding via the chat as well. The questions which I thought were interesting was the question around the role of politicians in police reform, and how do you account for that, and indeed incentivize or get police behind ordinary police behind reforms when there are political pressures going the other way. And a similar question about the role of police unions, which may create incentives or disincentives which perhaps are counter to the goals of reform and may pull officers' incentives behind reform into a different direction. So I'll turn to Ben, if I may, and then we'll to Rachel.
Yeah, thanks, Liam. On the trades union question, it pains me to say this as someone who's generally quite strongly in favour of trade unions. I think police trade unions have been quite a baleful influence in this area across many different concepts. I mean, you see that very clearly in the United States, where some of the police unions are frankly terrible in many ways and definitely pose a barrier to reform. And even in the UK, some of the stances the Police Federation takes on things, I think, are unfortunate, to say the least. The qualifier and the ray of sunshine there is, I'm not too sure how much credence most police officers place on what their unions are telling them. I mean, certainly if you talk to ordinary UK police officers, most of them ignore what the Police Federation says about particular issues, even though they might be members of it. I think I would very much go back to the argument that if the organisation is able to and is helped to be able to by the political structures within which it operates, to get the relationship with its members right, then the influence of the union should fade into the background somewhat, you're less likely to encounter some of the issues they encountered in the US in particular on this question. On the wider question of politics, I think probably everything that I said is more or less conditional on there being an appropriate political climate for this to take place in the first instance. And if there isn't an appropriate political climate in place, and that doesn't mean to say that the ruling party agrees with everything you're doing, it's much more a question about the political culture in a particular context. If that isn't amenable to these kinds of things, then I don't think much of what I said makes sense. And we're probably much more in the realms of some of the things that Shota was talking about in terms of making change. It's just that many of us are fortunate enough to live in countries where we can take for granted to some extent that there is an appropriate political culture in place and we can make these changes. And one of the benefits of policing in the UK, at least, and other parts of the world as well, is that the police can do this kind of in the face of what whoever happens to be in charge politically at the time is saying. Police leaders have a lot of power. And if there is a space for them to use that within that particular political culture, whether, whether our current Home Secretary thinks a thing or not, may be less important than the wherewithal and the willingness of police leaders to make positive changes. Perhaps I'm slightly over-optimistic, but, you know.
We need some optimism in this world, so. So Rachel, you've got a couple of minutes and then I'll have a minute to wrap up. Thank you, Ben.
Sure. I mean, the politics are extraordinarily complicated, aren't they? I think on the whole, policing is a political dead end for most political leaders. You very rarely get big political advantage out of trying to engage with police reform. There are exceptional circumstances. And I think it would be interesting to sort of look as well at the political aspects of the path dependency of different police reforms. So Paulo Mesquita, a long time in Brazil, said that in that region, there are really three drivers. Transitions, be they political or war to peace, scandal, human rights scandals typically, or modernization. Basically, these sort of ongoing technological and state modernization reforms frequently driven by the banks and donors, and that you could see different approaches to reform coming out of each of those different points of emphasis. The police, can just make life so difficult for politicians, I think, is the other thing. That we often don't pay much attention to, not just electorally, but especially around public order, but even sabotaging investigations and other sort of aspects of their daily business. It takes a huge amount of public pressure and anxiety for policing to rise to the level where it is worth political engagement and the attendant risks of that. And I actually think that the United States is one of the most prominent examples of that. It is only now, after everything that has gone on in this country, that you see state legislatures finally taking up some reforms. And they are not taking up the reforms that Black Lives Matter is asking for of defunding. They are starting to do some basic disciplinary and use of force reforms that have been on the table for decades. So there is a lag time between what becomes politically acceptable and what those who suffer most from bad policing are demanding. And it's one of the biggest challenges of these things. It is always better for a politician to have friendly cops in their pocket than it is to challenge them and reform them. And so how do you take advantage of those exceptional moments that arise in places like Georgia, in transitional or other moments? Unions are part of that equation, but even in places where police are not allowed to unionize, and in much of Latin America, there are only allowed associations and they're not formally allowed to strike, police are still incredibly powerful through political relations, dependency, all the rest of it. And the other thing that I think they can just outlast, they can pretend to go along with things that the politicians put forward, but they just sit tight because they know the politicians have a time frame on them, and they don't. They're still going to be there. So they're extraordinarily good at passive resistance. But I think, unions, we have to address their political power. If you look at the places with strongest unions at the moment, and the US is one, France is another, the political power and their ability to block reforms is just extraordinary. And it's really interesting that the civil society groups in this country, in the US now, are very focused on that, and they're getting into collective bargaining agreements. They are really getting into granular detail of the legal agreements that unions are setting up. And I just really quickly on diversity, it is essential that police look like the communities they serve. But studies in the US demonstrate that until you get officers of color and women into leadership positions, mm-hmm. it doesn't really change cultural practice. rather you end up with police of color who often face internal racism, very hostile workplaces, and in their communities are accused of being Oreos, the cookies, you know, black on the outside, white on the inside. So it's really tough. We do need to diversify. We need to bring women in, but we need to make sure that they don't have to deal with the double burden of an incredibly hostile workforce and a dubious community that they come from.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of the event. My first thing to say is a massive thank you to our panelists. Really interesting to the material I have gathered. I mean, you could write a PhD alone on half of it. And it's great to see both that joining of themes and regions. I think there is a lot of optimism still. Like, the quality of research and civil society, I think, has grown actually pretty substantively in the last 15 and 20 years. Yes, Ben, I think there is right to be, there is optimism. A reminder that we've got our next event on the 30th of April. So please check out the website on that. And a form will appear in your browser as per Dave's message in the chat. And we'd be grateful for any feedback. But I'll just sign off by saying thanks again to our panelists and for your participation in this event. So, great. Hey.